Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Thank you very much, Dave. Always a pleasure to hear my main man from Philadelphia right there. Oh, my goodness. Yes, we did take a breather on Tuesday. Now, the reason we did, the show did not go on because Mama Bear here was taking part in writing a song. I can't pretend to know music real well. I just wrote the words and I shipped it off to a buddy of mine that has been on this show, and hopefully he can make some music for it and we can do a little blurb or two about the holiday season. That's what it's all about. My name is Trish Hennessy. So glad you're with me today. Oh my gosh, this day has been a long time coming. Hold that thought. We're going to have music for you today, a little bit international, a little bit memorable. Maybe most of the folks who are listening today won't remember when this song first came out. I was just a little tyke, and I wasn't really immersed in jazz at that tender age, but you'll hear we're going to start the show off that way. And next hour, keep your fingers crossed, Wallace Roney comes here. He's going to be playing in New York tonight with Chick Corea, so I'm a little surprised he said yes to coming back. But we got everything straightened up from the first time he was supposed to be here. So away we go. Let's do something sweet, shall we? A birthday baby this month, God rest his soul, Don Cherry with the Ornette Coleman Quintet from 1958 on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Was The Blessing, The Bullfighter, and The Man Who Loves His Bed. That was a gentleman by the name of Kad Achouri, who is of Spanish and Algerian descent, lived in the south of France, lived in Barcelona for a while, and now lives in London. Little international flair for you. That song was called J'aime mon lit, which means I love my bed. And I got it from the Put Mayo Presents Jazz Around the World CD, which I just love. Anything that Put Mayo puts out that closely resembles jazz or globally inspired music that can be persuaded as jazz, I'm all over it. This guy is just so fascinating because he's got that groovy, sensual voice. That's actually from his second CD in 2005. He goes back and forth. Needless to say, he has a lot of world influences, but he gravitates to jazz that's flavored with hip-hop and some classics. Kurt Cobain, yes, and Cole Porter, all rolled into one. And that is Kad, C-A-D. So look him up. He's fascinating. I want to delve more into him as time permits down the highway. Groove School, we've delved into quite a bit. You've heard Christian Dimasonas, who was on the show some days ago, and thegrooveschoolband.com is where you'll want to go to find out more. That's groove, just like the word, S-K-O-O-L. The song you heard was The Bullfighter. Can't say enough about this CD, the debut from Groove School. Just amazing. Personnel, Christian, the heart and soul of the group on bass. The genius is Kevin Grogan on piano. Rhythm is Nick Costa on drums. The melody on saxophone, and lovely saxophone, that is Kevin Anderson, and the fire, Mike Gamble on guitar. Now, this coming Monday, we're taping this on the 17th, Gordon Lightfoot's birthday, everybody. God bless him. He's 73 today. Blues Alley is where Groove School is going to be on Monday, and you can get your tickets via grooveschoolband.com. If you are in the area or want to be, just right before Thanksgiving, it might be a really cool time to see the 8 o'clock or the 10 o'clock show. Yeah, and then Don Cherry with Ornette Coleman and his quintet. How lovely was that? The Blessing from Live in L.A., Hillcrest Performance, 1958, recorded in October. Don and Ornette had a long association. I'm going to focus a little bit on Don because he's a November baby. He was born November 18th, 1936, passed away in 1995. And Okie to L.A., got more into African instrumentation as time went on with his trips to Africa. But he was basically a cornetist and a pocket trumpeter. And what a metamorphosis he went through as a jazz musician. Straight to avant-garde, to a more global vision of what the genre could be. Just real cool. Worked with or in association with or on the same stage, Sonny Rollins, Archie Shepp, Art Farmer, Sun Ra, Gatto Barbieri, and I just am digging so much the body of work that he had created. He's, to my mind, he doesn't get enough credit, and I know that there are some who agree with me, but this long association with Ornette Coleman was real significant in the world of jazz. On that particular piece of work, by the way, pianist Paul Bley, Ed Blackwell trading back and forth on trumpet, bass Charlie Hayden on the drums, Billy Higgins, and of course on alto sax, Ornette Coleman. And we'll certainly get more into Ornette as time goes on. We're going to hurry up too, because he's going to be 82 in March. Isn't that cool? I'm so glad that he's still walking among us. This is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Wallace Roney comes up next hour, and we're going to have, in the meantime, somebody else who's coming to our area in Baltimore tomorrow night, a tribute to Charlie Byrd, one of the most interesting guitarists there was. Nate Najjar, at the age of 30, unbelievable what he has accomplished in those 30 years, definitely an old soul. This is from his latest CD. This is a track called One Day at a Time. Can I get an amen from that? Enjoy this. I know you will.
Have you found your
That's my girl. As we edge closer to the Thanksgiving holiday and get full swing into this season, it just behooves us to play the songs that sound warm and fuzzy and grateful and seasonal. So there you go, Tracy Hamlin and Seasons from her CD of the same name a few years back. Tracy Hamlin, a buddy of mine, and I'm just so thrilled that this Baltimore gal is doing so well. She is blown away. Not only has she found the love of her life, but she is doing what she loves to do in life, what she must do. That voice is incredible. She is now touring with Starpoint. They just did a gig in Lyon, France, and Tracy's had a wild and wacky, wonderful year with Gloria Gaynor. She's doing her solo thing. She's singing with other people, and more information can be found at TracyHamlin.com. On that particular track, just to let you know, Tracy's background has been with everybody from Carlos Santana to Marcus Miller to Pieces of a Dream, and indeed, James Lloyd is on that track. Yeah, Seasons. And let me see who else is here, because I certainly want to point out to you that Eric Valentine is on keyboard, drum, and drum programming. Alan Johnson on Rhodes and Strings. What a talent he is. David Dyson on bass, one of the best. Alvin White on acoustic guitar. She had her A-team there that day. Tracy Hamlin, H-A-M as in Mary, L-I-N. Abstract Truth we heard from right before Tracy from Philadelphia, my hometown. And that was a song called Seasons Change from a few years back as well. CD of the same name, abstracttruthmusic.com. You can find out more. I'm excited because they do have a more recent CD, but they're going to have a new one in 2012. Just heard from my buddy G. Lawrence Francis in the past 24 hours with a new song that was composed for a wonderful wedding. So I believe that's going to be on the new CD. G. Lawrence on bass, Scott Coulter on keyboard, Jesse Andrus playing any wind instrument you could possibly name, and Rajul doing percussion, Sultan Akbar on drums. If you are making plans, not for New Year's Eve, but for New Year's Day, you might want to check out the Rufus Harley Cafe in Philadelphia on the first day of 2012. That's where Abstract Truth has been for the past couple of years. Sounds like a kick. Nate Najjar from his CD Until Now, One Day at a Time. Nate, that wonderful Wiley Wascal guitar player, is going to be at Germano's Trattoria in Little Italy in Baltimore tomorrow night as part of a Charlie Bird tribute with Chuck Redd and Tommy Cecil, who used to play with Charlie Bird. God bless his soul. If you are into and in the area for Brazilian or swing or Ellington music, the kind of music that Nate does so well and beyond that, Germano's, G-E-R-M-A-N-O, Germano's, Trattoria.com has more information, as well as Nate Najjar, N-A-J-A-R.com. He is also going to be in Rock Hall, I believe, tonight, and Annapolis on Saturday. So he's in the Maryland area. Yay! Nate, we had a ball with him on Cool Jazz Conversations the other night with Joy Hall. I do have a phone number for you if you want to make reservations, 410-752-4515. 410-752-4515. Germano's is a sweet venue. Oh, my goodness. Was there for the Amy Shook scenario, the Fab Trio. It was wonderful a few weeks ago, and they treated us like royalty, my son and I. Let's dip into a little sound for the season, shall we? And I should tell you that Nate, he was with us the other night. Now it's going to be Wallace Roney's turn, at the top of the next hour. So I'm a little excited. As you remember, Wallace was scheduled to be with us, but he did not know that he had a scheduling conflict. He was doing a documentary at the same time he was supposed to be doing the interview. So hopefully everything is cool. My fingers are crossed. Let's get into some Jerry Mulligan and Paul Desmond, shall we? This is called Winter Song on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you. This is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll say. I'd give another whistle if I could. Listen, it was no mistake to be playing Wireless Roni back-to-back with Jerry Mulligan and Paul Desmond from 1957 from the Quartet CD, that little Christmas, if you will, holiday feel of Winter Song, which is based on the chord changes to These Foolish Things. I wanted to juxtapose those sounds to you. So anybody who's listening now or in the archives to come can understand that greatness still reigns in jazz. And I am not kidding. I've been waiting for a while to be able to say this. Let me just say that this is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy, and we are about to hear the voice of somebody who has mastered greatness. You know what? You grab onto a gift early on, as this man did, and you hang on. Times may get tough, but you know you have your gift, and you keep on going. This man, I could say a number of things about, a Downbeat Magazine Award winner multiple times, made his recording debut at the age of 14, a fellow Philadelphian, ladies and gentlemen, and the only person who can say that he was personally mentored by Miles Davis. But let me tell you something, that's a wonderful thing. Light years beyond what Miles could have ever dreamed is Wallace Roni on the phone with me now. Wallace.
Hi, Trish.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm glad we're doing this.
Me too, my friend. I'm so glad to hear you. Dawn is an absolute fabulous person to have in your corner, is she not?
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
She is.
Thank you for that.
Oh, my God, she's just wonderful and sweet and just full of customer service stuff. If I could mold Dawn, I would. But this interview is about you, and I'm astounded because I looked at your schedule, and you've been playing with Chick Corea last night and tonight. You're going to do that tonight,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, yes.
Well, I appreciate the time you're taking then.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It really is.
Well, bless your heart. And I don't even know where to begin because your background is so staggering, and I know that you're flying full force into the next few weeks because you're going to be in Nigeria around Thanksgiving and then Brazil in December. God knows what 2012 has held. What are you doing these days? I guess you're doing these really special events here and there. What can I usually wait till the end for this, but what can we expect in 2012 from Wallace Roni?
You know, I don't know. I just, you know, I'm very blessed and fortunate to be working and playing my music. This thing we're doing with Chick, he called it 4 Miles, and bless his heart, he let me lead it. And we're playing some of the music. He did. He let me sort of lead it, and we're playing the music that Miles played with, that I played with VSOP, actually, Wayne's music. It's the harder, most innovative music that Miles was doing. You know, we're doing Nefertiti, and we're doing some of the things that happened when Chick was in the band, because I kind of insist on including that, and we're doing it from our perspective, but not letting down what made those things so unique and innovative. So we're tackling the bull head on, and then we're putting our own individuality on it too. And I'm looking, and that's what I've been doing all my life, basically, taking what has happened with this great music we call jazz, and see if I can not sacrifice the uniqueness of it, but see if I can bring something, put my own ideas into it, interject my own ideas as well. If I can add to the language.
Well, you really have, Wallace. It's been amazing the number of people, because you've been doing this for a while. I mean, you're not an older man by any stretch. You're right there at your season now. Because believe me, I'm always looking at this because you're younger than me. So I always look to see about ages and how much people have accomplished in their age. You were doing this at a young age, and you were tapped as being gifted I'm so blown away because I grew up in Philly with Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yeah.
He had his eye on you at a young age. How did you get involved in the classics and then delve from what your training had been into the forays of jazz?
Well, jazz is, first of all, there's really not much difference between jazz and classical music except the language, the style, and the intention. You have to master your instrument. You have to know the rudiments of music. And my intention always was to learn how to play the trumpet so I can play this music. And the way you play this music, you have to learn, you know, what it takes. And so I took lessons from a gentleman named Sigmund Herring, who was playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And he had me play with the brass ensemble, Philadelphia Brass Ensemble, and I played with them, and that's how that whole thing came about. And the Philadelphia Brass Ensemble was an outgrowth of students that he had and people that was connected with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Mm.
So that's how
wow.
I was. And I was very serious about learning classical music because classical music is classical because it's beautiful. You know, jazz is more unique of a music because it's unique to us, but it's also improvised. So you got the benefit of being a composer, and a virtuoso soloist at the same time. So that's what makes this music even more unique.
That's a beautiful way to articulate the association of classical and jazz because, you know, I'm a big believer, we've talked about this on the show ad infinitum, but, you know, once you have the instrumentation of the genre of classics or jazz, you are in a position to heal. It becomes everybody's music, which is why the classics are so. Through the hundreds of years now, people have embraced that music because a piece resonates with somebody, and it could be resonating in France or Algeria or the United States or wherever, Bermuda. There's no words, so it becomes everybody's music.
Yeah.
And do you think it's important for as somebody who's loving the idea of jazz, who wants to be involved in jazz as a musician, do you think it's important to delve into classics first, or what do you think of that? I've never asked anybody that question before.
Well, yes, because classics is going to give you a firm grasp of how of the mastery of this instrument. Yeah.
Huh.
So I believe that. But you can get it from jazz, too, when we get a systematic way of teaching it, which people are starting to do now. I got my son, he's playing trumpet, he's playing amazing, and he's learning from a jazz perspective, but the techniques are techniques that were instrumental in classical music, you know, but you should hear him, he's amazing.
Really? That's fabulous. Oh, my God, you must be so proud when you hear that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a number of things to say about you and your background, and I know that you've been asked ad infinitum about the first time that you met Miles, and I am so intrigued with the idea that during the 80s, things were not so cool for you, and you found yourself at different friends and sleeping over and just hanging out and trying to get your footing back into where you needed to be. The times that you've had, Ornette Coleman, Art Blakey, Herbie Hancock, Sonny Rollins, McCoy Tyner, Joni Mitchell, Dizzy Gillespie, all these names that you have shared space, time, and talent with, do you recall going back to a memory that makes you really happy when you think about different times in the past few decades? Do you gravitate to that?
Yeah, I do, and I'll tell you, it's not as bad as it sounds. See, when you love this music, you want to do what you have to do to play this music. You're really dedicated to it. And it wasn't like I had hard times. there were a bunch of us in New York that was coming from all parts of the world that really wanted to play this music. It was me, it was Steve Coleman, it was Margaret Miller, and we all were the new guys on, and you know, Lonnie Plaxico and Eric Allen, and we all were the new cats trying to establish ourselves in this music. And since we coming from different places in the world, we don't have a home here, and we didn't have no gig, we had no money.
And it is New York. I mean, it is
right, New York, right. Right. You only can stay in the Y for a couple weeks with $100. And we all were doing that. We all were, but we were doing it because we loved the place. So, like, one of our friends, like Robin Eubanks, who was a friend of mine from Philly anyway, and his brother Kevin, you know, they were lucky enough to have a gig inside the place. So I stayed there, you know. Steve Coleman probably stayed other places. Small group, you know, we all did what we had to do because maybe that next week Dexter Gordon is in town, and we all want to see if we're going to get a chance to play with Dexter or get the gig with Dexter or get the gig with Woody or, you know, Margaret's case, he came to play with Woody at the time. Or I wanted to play with Art Blakey or, you know, so if they were in town and you didn't have no place to stay, you had to stay in town so you can, you know, go to the gig and listen to the gig and learn the book. And we all would sit there and listen to the book. We all have respect for those guys, too. We wouldn't just go to them and say, I want to play.
Right.
We would wait like 2 or 3 days and learn the book. And then we'd go to them on an off day, like a Thursday, and say, Mr. Henderson, I did this, you know. With Joe Henderson, actually, I went the first day because I had to leave. But you'd go to them on Thursday and say, listen, I would like, is it possible that I could sit in with you? I'd love a chance to play with you. And they might say, usually, well, we don't let anyone say that. And we'll say, well, I understand, but I've been listening and I learned your book. And that would they would say, you know my book? You know my music? And we'll say, yes, sir. And I would like the chance to play. And then he would say, well, do you know such and such? And you say, yeah. And he said, well, come on up. And then you come up. And you play, and at the end of the night, somebody might walk. We all used to go to this restaurant at the end of the night, all of us. It'd be gangs of us in this restaurant, and we all be at the table. We never had no money, but we could probably buy a piece of cheesecake or something and share it. And we'd say, and someone would come and say, man, did you hear about such and such? He just got the gig with Johnny Griffin. And everybody's like, yeah, oh, man. And this woman's like, well, I'm going to try to get the gig with such and such, you know, and we all be happy, and that's what we would do. And then, but then there would be occasionally a time when someone would go to the great guys and say, I know your music, and you didn't know it. Like, I saw this happen with Elvin once, and this guy wanted to play with Elvin, and Elvin didn't really want him to play. And he convinced Elvin, and he got up on the bandstand, and he sounded terrible. And Elvin stopped, he said, you sound terrible. You don't know my music.
Back up. Wow.
But it was a great lesson for us, too, because none of us wanted it that sad. So we would say, oh, man, we're not going to get taken like Patrick did, you know. So we all go back and we say, Patrick's a fictional name. I'm not telling who it really
right.
was. And we go back over and make sure we practice if we want the gig with Elvin. And that's what happened. And you'd have no place to stay. So you'd ask your friend, and they would say, come on, you can stay there. And you might wind up staying longer than they want you to. You say, okay, it's time to leave. And then maybe, you know, somebody may have a car or something. You're just hanging out until the nighttime comes, you know, because the gigs used to start at 10 o'clock. So you hang out. You play all day. We used to go to each other's house and play, or go to, you know, a loft and play, and then wait till the nighttime so you can come to the gig, and you try to be as clean as you can, even though you ain't got no place. You know what I mean? And that's what it was in those days. That's what it was like.
Oh, man, that's so wild. And, of course, it makes me think, yeah, I guess a lot of musicians go through that. It's just that with you, Wallace, honest to gosh, I think of you as jazz royalty. So if I'm thinking along those lines, it's hard for me to believe that you ever suffered even a little bit. But actually, the best have. I mean, times are never really on easy street if you're going to New York because prices are so high. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, back in those days when the clubs were really popping in New York, it must have been crazy.
It was. And they didn't, the club owners didn't always let you in, but you try to convince them. And, yeah, you know, you say that it's hard to imagine you suffer. But, yeah, we did a lot of suffering back then, but the music made up for it. And a lot of people went home. That's the other thing. A lot of people didn't have what it take. You know, they split. You know, they might have been had promise on their instrument, but part of that promise is sticking it out. And while you're sticking it out, getting better and justifying it, that's what makes a Miles Davis look at you or what makes a McCoy Tyner look at you, because they see that you put your dues in. The ones that came here with a gig, you know, that's nice. They came with a gig, but you wonder, well, if you didn't have the gig or if you didn't walk in with a record contract and you had to pay, had to do this because you love it, would you still be here? Well, some of us show we're still here, you know.
And did Miles really look at people that way? What was it about Miles Davis when he saw you?
I'll tell you something about Miles Davis that is really great. Miles Davis at that point was beyond everybody. He was beyond everybody in terms of music. Now, you're talking about musical royalty. He was like a prince. And he was, and so was Art Blakey too, but Miles had that shining prince thing where he was the leading cutting-edge artist. And Miles Davis, whether you believed it or not or whether he said it or not, he listened to everybody. He listened to all the jazz musicians, and he was listening to the pop artists because that's where he was trying to take his sound. But for his listening to play the music, he was listening to all the jazz artists. So he knew all the young trumpet players that was out there. One time he told me, he said, when we were about to do Montrose, he said, "That's going to make you famous." I told him like that the other day. He said, "Because you need to be out there because the rest of those guys are getting away with murder."
But wow.
What he looked for, I think Miles, he used to say he could tell. He told me, I remind him of him. He said, I looked at him just like he used to look at Dizzy. He said, he could tell by the way I hold my horn. And he was right. I loved him, you know, and I studied him. And what the way he heard me was on a night they did this retrospective of his life.
Right, 1983, right? Yeah.
Right. And there were seven trumpet players got up there, and we played a couple chords of the blues with Herbie, Tony, and Ron. And this is, I know, I'm only telling these stories as truthfully as I can remember them.
Yeah.
And I remember when we had the rehearsal, man, first of all, when they told me this was going to happen, I couldn't believe it because I was really the young guy at the band. I was the unknown guy. And when we got to the rehearsal was Tony and Herbie and Ron, my heroes.
Yeah.
But Tony, Herbie, and Ron looked like, oh, man, we got to go through all this. Like, I don't want to play through these for all these trumpet players. And I kind of understood that, too. I could see that because they would look like they were like, ah. So we started playing Walking, the blues. And, you know, and everybody was taking a solo. And you could see them going through the motions like, when are we through? But when I took a solo, I started playing something. And all of a sudden, I could hear Tony tighten up and start responding. And Herbie was responding, and Ron was responding, and it scared me, actually. I said something, and they go, boom, boom. I said, oh, I didn't expect that, you know? And when I finished my solo, they were smiling. And I was like, you know, and I was a little, you know, it kind of caught me. So then Slot Hampton was the music director. He said, let's do it again. And at that point, though, I could see Tony and I were like, oh, no, we don't need to rehearse this again. But we did it again, And when I played again, the same thing happened. They responded, and they started smiling more. Then Ron Carter called me over. He said, "Hey, man, what's your name?" I said, Wallace Roney. He said, "Hey, Tony, Herbie, come here. This is Wallace Roney." That's when I first met them. And they were, and Herbie said, "Yeah, nice, man, nice." And Tony looked at me and smiled. I'll never forget, Tony just looked at me and smiled like, they shook my hand. Ron hugged me. They shook my hand. Then when I got on the bandstand that night, that Sunday night to play the gig, the exact same thing happened on stage. Those guys responded behind me and not anybody else. And it even got written up in the paper like that. And after we played and Miles' band played and came up, Miles got his award, honorary degree, and his band played, and I stayed for that. After it was over, our farmer said, "Hey, Wallace, your man wants to meet you. He wants to talk to you."
No way.
Yeah, and I was like, "Huh?" He said, "He wants to talk to you. Now, come on. I know you want to talk to your man." I looked at Art, man, and Art said, and we were on the basement floor in Radio City. That's where our dressing room was. And they had this big elevator, and he started walking the elevator. Art didn't even think that I wasn't going to come with him. And he was going to the elevator, and I kind of stepped back. And my brother said, "Man, you better go on, man. You never know when this is going to happen. This might not happen again."
Exactly.
So I walked on that elevator. It was padded. We went up to, like, the fourth floor. That's where Miles was. And Miles said the same thing. He heard me. I heard you up there with those guys. I guess he heard the rapport, the way I was playing. And then he gave me his phone number. He said, "Call me tomorrow." And, man, that was one of the greatest moments of my entire life right there.
Of course. Of course. Man, that's so unbelievable, Wallace. And I know. I mean, you read different accounts and you hear different stories of how that went down. Thank you for letting me know that, because I've been wondering about that for the past couple of years. And that is the coolest thing ever. I mean, here you are. You are the unknown in the group.
Right.
And you were hungry. And what you just said struck me, because that was the truth. I mean, you could feel that the other guys who were doing this retrospective, they were waiting to get off the stage. You felt that?
Well, no, not the trumpet players. No, Herbie and Tony and Ron was.
Okay.
No, other trumpet players, they were playing. They were with my best friend John Faddis was playing. He was trying to play his best. Randy Brecker was there. Randy sounded good too. Luke Soloff, Jimmy Owens, and Art Farmer, of course, and Mayor Ferguson. I think it was the way I was playing. See, Trish, you know, not only was I serious, I was serious about trying to play this music and play it to a higher level. Not that they weren't.
Right.
But maybe I was seriously trying to approach what Herbie and them was trying to do even before I played with them. You know, I knew that the things that they were going for was really what was the most advanced in this music. And I'm practicing 8 hours a day, so by the time I got up on that bandstand on that rehearsal and played with them, my whole approach was what had come through that music. I mean, John was spitting out fire now, but maybe I understood, or I naturally played in the way that Herbie understood, you know, or Tony understood.
You were plain and simple. You were hungry. That's what you were.
I was.
Yeah.
But I was also turning them corners in a different way than they were. I was definitely turning the corners differently than the way Randy and those guys were. You know, I was definitely trying to use the upper parts of where the music was going, you know. So.
And you were paying attention as opposed to, and, you know, not to take anything away from anybody else, but people in a situation like that, artists who are sharing the stage with a hero, they want to try to show off. Meanwhile,
yeah.
you were paying attention to where the groove was going to go.
I was definitely paying attention. And but I also got, I keep trying to say, though, I think I also was turning a different corner than those guys were. I was going this way, and I was, you know, they might have been going in a certain way, and I was definitely trying to go higher, at a higher, not higher, but, you know, more abstract, or not abstract, more poly, I don't know what it was. I was trying to turn the corner differently than the usual way to turn it, and I think that resonated with Herbie and resonated with Tony, you know.
Well, whatever those circumstances, you were at the right place at the right time, more so than most people can say. Holy cow.
Right.
Wow.
Right. And Miles heard it. That's the thing. Miles heard it, and he heard where I was going, and when he invited me to his house, that was the most beautiful thing before. Well, actually, the first thing Miles Davis said to me, and this was no offense to anybody, this is what he said to me. He said, "I never liked Brianna. I was a brown." That's the first thing he said. He said, "Not that I was jealous or anything. I didn't think he played as good as everybody thought." He said, "And he played fast all the time because he couldn't swing. Him and Max played fast all the time, and Max stopped swinging when he left Bird." That's the first thing Miles said when I got in his house.
Man.
I guess he was saying to me, is you coming out of me, you're not coming out of Clifford. But actually, I did love Clifford Brown. I loved Clifford. But I was going to listen to what he had to say in his point of view, because he was the master. I wanted to learn. And Clifford Brown loved Miles Davis. I knew that too, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, boy.
So I wanted to hear his point of view. And it became a beautiful protege mentorship. From 83 up to the end of his life, me listening to what he had to say, you know?
That was a good chunk of time. And not only that, I mean, he took so much time with you, but I love the fact that you you were without your horn one night, or you didn't have any, and you told him that, and he said, "Well, here, take mine."
Well, it wasn't quite like that. That was that same night. I played at Carnegie Hall. I didn't have a horn. It was part of that whole experience of just trying to make it in New York. And what had happened, to be really honest, I had a beautiful Martin committee that I had when I was a kid, a Martin Magna. And when I went to school and I heard Art was looking for a trumpet player, I sold my horn to get to New York. That's what I did. And I borrowed a friend of mine's horn from Boston named Larry Brown. And he had a con trumpet that was sitting in the window of a flower pot. And he wasn't thinking of nothing of it, so I borrowed it and went down and sat in with Art and made the gig with Art and joined Art. This was 1981. Right. But the horn had some flaws. It actually was a perfect horn for what I could have done, but I didn't know how to fix the horn. So at that point, I went and I got a Bach trumpet, which never worked out for me. People like Bach. That's fine. It didn't have any personality, and Woody Shaw used to tell me that too. But I got Bach, and I couldn't afford it. So what I would do, I had a friend that worked in this great store called Giardinelli's, and I would go borrow the Bach like I was going to buy it for 7 days or something, 10 days. And then I'd go back and before the 7 days up and try another one. And I wound up doing that for a long time, switching horns. And they would let me because my friend was there. Mr. Giardinelli kind of knew. I think they all liked me. They thought I was going to do something in the music. So they turned a blind eye. And by the time I did the Radio City thing, that's what it was. I really didn't have a horn. I was kind of borrowing a horn. So that's when I went over to Miles' house. And when I got the horn is when I went over his house the next day.
Okay. I'm glad you set that story straight, because that's another question mark that I had for you. Because, my God, I know that you could tell stories. And I know, I'm not sure if they ever approached you, because for the past couple of years, I was hearing that there is going to be a movie done about the life of Miles. And I heard that Don Cheadle was going to play the title role. And I thought, well, I hope they're talking to the right people about getting stories straight, and you would be one of those folks. Have you ever been approached?
No, they never talk to me. It's funny, you know, when you ever look at all these documentaries that come out on Mile, they never ask me anything. They ask these people, and then none of them been around Mile.
Right.
I don't know why they ask these other people, and none of them been around Miles except Herbie and Chick and those guys, but they got these other people, you know, it's like they don't want to ask me or they don't. But, I mean, I was hanging with him since 83 up to 91, up to the end, and everybody knows it. And I remember when I was hanging with him, there was a whisper, you know, why was I hanging out with Miles? But people didn't want to believe it. And then one day he gave me his horn. So, you know, and then I'll never forget, I walked on the stage with the blue trumpet. And people said, he got a blue trumpet. You know, Miles knew how to be dramatic, too, you know. But he knew I loved that horn, you know, so he gave me the blue one. And I went on stage. I remember I went up with Tony Williams, and Tony saw the horn. Tony said, you've been hanging with Dave. I said, yeah.
Man. And what did it feel like? I mean, I know that you had this chunk of time with him that was pretty extraordinary. But still, I mean, here you are at Montreux in 1991. Was it a total surprise to you to be part of that scenario?
Well, honestly, no. It wasn't. Yes, it was, and no, it wasn't. I'll tell you why it wasn't. Because he said it to me probably a year or two before it happened. He kept telling me if he played his straight ahead music again, he wanted me to play with him because I play all his stuff perfect. He kept telling me that. And he was also hinting that he was going to do something with Gil and with the quintet, but I didn't believe it. So when it actually happened, yeah, it was a shock. When it actually happened, it happened in July. I was over there with George Grunt. Now, honestly, I might have said whatever I said to be humble, but I tell you, I had gotten off. I had played Wolf Trap with Tony Williams in June, and Miles was playing in Philadelphia the same day. I finished my gig with Tony, and I got on a train and went to Philly. He was playing opposite Shirley Horn. You want to look it up, you can see him telling the truth. And I got off the train, and I went to see him, and afterwards, he said it then. He said, we can rake over. We're going to do that. But I didn't really believe. I felt like, man, if he gets up there, he's got to do it. They don't really want me to do it. He's just being nice. And sure enough, when I got there, well, first of all, he didn't show up for the first rehearsal. Well, he showed up for the first rehearsal. He showed up late. And I didn't think about it. I just went up there, and I played, you know, I went to play his parts. But everybody kind of knew I was going to play his part. But I wasn't expecting to really play it on the gig. Now, that did shock me. I really thought I was just going to cover the rehearsal and let him do it. Because I used to cover his rehearsals when he didn't feel like making it at home, you know, with his band.
Right.
He got up there, and he just kept me up there. He said, come on, play this, play that, keep playing. And it became like King Oliver and Louis Armstrong, you know. It was amazing, and that's how I got up there to play it. That's why I was playing it. He kept me up there. I really wasn't expecting to play it, even though he had been saying that. I figured this was his moment. I really was just going to enjoy the show, you know. I wanted to be there, you know. It was good enough I was hanging in his room with him, you know.
And did you just hear yourself? Because that is so funny that you just said that you just thought he was being nice. Now, you knew Miles Davis well enough to know that he wasn't nice for the sake of being nice. He pretty much let you know what was going on in his head, did he not?
Well, that's true. That is true. But still, he was such an amazing person. You know, I got to do a lot of things hanging with him. And even up to the moment I did some stuff, you don't believe that you're really doing it. It's almost like pinching yourself, you know?
Yeah.
I even found a tape of him calling at the house, you know, from the old answering machine. You know, yeah. When you had the machines and you had the tape.
Said, oh, yeah, you still have it?
Yeah, he said, Wallace, pick up. It's me. He said, look, he said, to see Miles Davis. And so we don't know if Miles Davis, you know.
Oh, my gosh. That is one of your priceless treasures right there.
Yeah.
And you know what? You sound like you're still flying, like you're still pinching yourself about all of this journey, because you sound, bless your heart, like you still have that childlike spirit in you that gets excited about the music. I'm so.
Thank you. I do.
Yeah, I can tell, and I'm so if about tonight. I should have investigated more. I didn't know about tonight, and I should have made plans because I could have gone to New York, but now I'm going to do something else. What time is that gig start tonight?
We play at 8 and at 10, and it's really good. I always hate doing Miles tributes. I always said I would hate it. Except for the ones that involved the guys that actually played with him, like VSOP. That was one of the greatest bands ever, Herbie, Tony,
yeah.
Ron, and Wayne. And then this band with Jack and Chick and Gary, you know. So it's a pleasure. And then I took the band out with Benny Maupin and Buster and Al Foster and Bobby and Doug Klein. That was good. But, you know, this band has been a pleasure to play with. I must admit, you know, and I want to say one other thing about my time with Miles, Trish.
Please.
You know, as I was hanging with him, I was enjoying some great things, you know, but I was playing with, one of the things I think Miles appreciated about me was I wasn't an entourage. I was an artist on the scene, you know. I was almost like his representing who he was, you know.
Yeah.
And he knew that I was, you know, I was playing with Tony, I was playing with McCoy, I was playing with all the cats, and I was justifying his reasoning for choosing me, basically. He felt at the time I was the best person out there, best representing his goals and dreams of music, so I wasn't just a hanger-oner. When I get through hanging, I'd go out and I'm going to play. You know, I'm playing at, I'm getting ready to go on the road, you know. I remember one time he said to me, what time is your gig? I said, well, I was supposed to leave today. He said, where is it at? I'll take you. I told him the gig was in Canada. He looked at me and said, you better get going.
I love it. Oh, wow, he's a trip, my God.
Yeah.
That must have been so. And here's the thing about you in doing research about Wallace Roney. You are such an amalgam of what your experience has been, because I don't know if people forget about this regarding you, but the education that you had when you were a little guy in Philly and then Howard University and Berkeley and under the tutelage of some folks that meant something in the classic and jazz world, you had these wide array of influences, and then you got immersed by so many in the jazz scene. And, you know, I don't know of anybody who has the kind of career that you have, because you are the personification of what Miles could do. And then there is Wallace Roney, who has all this other stuff coming out of him.
Right. Well, I think that's what it is, you know. It's a continuum, and you're right. I was very fortunate. I had great music teacher Sigmund Herring and Langston Fitzgerald. They were great, you know, Fred Irby. But then I had Clark Terry and Dizzy Gillespie, you know.
Yep.
And Clark Terry taught me more about legitimate trumpet playing than anybody, you know. He really did. And then you got Dizzy, who taught me more about technical stuff, you know. And then I had Woody. Woody was a mentor. I mean, Woody showed me a lot of things. I tell you, Woody Shaw did something for me that was really great. When I first was going to play with Art Blakey, I mean, to join the Jazz Messengers, they were having auditions, and Wynton Marsalis was trying to had recommended Terrence Blanchard. I didn't know Terrence Blanchard at the time, and I came to New York a day early because I just wanted to be there. And Woody was playing at a club called 7th Avenue South. And Woody said, you know, Art's turning the band over again. And I said, yeah, I heard. But I was thinking in my head, man, I played in the big band. Why? I don't know why they didn't call me anyway. But Woody said, well, you know that's supposed to be your gig. And I said, well, you know, I'm hoping. He said, well, look, I'm going to tell you what. I want you to play with me tonight. This is what Woody did. He said, I want you to play with me tonight because you're going to be nervous when you get up there and sit in with Art.
So oh, my gosh, that's so cool.
I know, isn't it nice? He said, I
yes.
want you to work your nerves off tonight. And he let me play the whole with him, you know, at 7th Avenue South. Honest to goodness.
Man, that was a friend. Wow.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, that's a mentor. So I had these guys, but I'll tell you, even the Woody Shaw and all these guys looked up to Miles Davis. They knew who Miles Davis was. They knew that Miles Davis was a step or two higher, you know? You know, they knew. So all that preparing me to keep going forward to reach Miles, you know?
Well, there was something in Miles that, and I really do think this, and you can certainly say if you disagree or not, but sometimes I think that the genius comes from a source of pain that you cannot describe. Nobody can articulate it, and they don't want to articulate it. But you have to do something with that core of pain. And the way it comes out is through playing or singing or whatever creativity you can find to quell that, to make it healthy, to make keep yourself sane. And that's him, I think. You know, he's so fascinating to me as a character. And here I am talking to you, and you are so centered, Wallace. And I think that as much as you gravitated to him because you appreciated his genius, he gravitated to you because you centered him.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, maybe that's true.
I think so. Because there's a, I didn't expect this from you. I didn't know really what to expect. But as you talk, I feel this comforting spirit. You were able to talk him down from the ledge, even in times when you didn't know that he needed to be talked down. He really gravitated to you because he needed you in his life for balance. You were the anchor in many ways. I really feel that.
It might be something to that. It might be almost like him looking back at himself, too, and seeing the things he should have done or could have done or getting, you know, almost sort of like you would do your son. You know, you would see something, and your son can rejuvenate you in a way or give you that extra lift or hope. I dare say that about myself, and I don't know. But so let me just qualify that by saying maybe he saw, like he said, he saw me and him, and he was re-nourishing himself that
and,
way. It's very possible. It's very possible because he would say that a lot to me, you know. And he would say a lot of nice things, you know. But more than that, I got so much out of him. We used to spend time. I used to hear him play things on the trumpet, or I'd see he'd go to the piano and show me these things, and or, you know, like he would play some chords, and he would say, find this note in this chord. And then he would move the chord up. He said, now find it here. And these things are, I'll never forget them, because everybody I talk to say he never taught music to them. I'm thinking about, what? It seems like he always taught music to me. You know?
I think that you have something about that father-son thing, because, you know, I've got a 19-year-old son myself, and from a mom-son situation, you want to be able to tell the people that make you feel maternal or paternal what to do as well as what not to do. And
right.
if you're trying to mold their lives the way that you envision them to be happy and fruitful, I
right.
think you have it. That's what he wanted to do for you.
I think so. And I think he saw, like I said, I think he saw himself. Like, I remember one time he told me, he said, how come the critics don't write about me, you know? And I told him, I said, well, you know, they're trying to prop somebody else up. It was, you know, there was another trumpet player that they really were getting behind. And then that's when he was saying these guys are getting away with murder. And then he said, and I said, plus, they try to say that I'm a clone of you. I'm trying to clone you. He said, don't listen to them. I hear what you're doing. You keep doing what you're doing. Because, he said, you know, because I was trying to, he knew I was trying to get all of what he was doing and trying to take it to another level. He said, you keep doing that, because if you don't, they'll be playing you instead of you doing what you're supposed to do. And he
Ooh.
Said, so he said, yeah, so then I said, thank you. And I said, but, you know, they write negative stuff about me and you too. And I said, and at that time they had just written something bad about me and them on separate articles. And, you know, because they would write bad stuff about me to push this other guy to show, you know, because they were trying to pop this guy. And I said, and then they would get personal. I said, I'm one of these guys, you know, I feel like I want to go punch him in the mouth. Mom said, don't do that. Don't do that. I did that. And all that did was get me a lot of lawsuits. He said, but if you do it, I ain't going to stop you.
Oh, my gosh. What a trip. Oh, my God. It must have been entertaining, like, all the doggone day.
It was great.
Well, I'm not going to keep you. I'm going to ask you one more question. I'm going to let you get out, and I'm going to play a song after you go. What would you like to see happen with you now, Wallace? Do you have a dream that you want to make real? Tell me that.
Well, my dream is, my dream is to be able to keep playing and keep working with my band and music and with Herbie and Chick and all these great artists and young artists that coming up too, you know, and to keep playing and keep having a way to play, a place to play. You know, a lot of these clubs are trying to shut us out for things I don't understand, you know, but we need venues to play
yeah.
where we can keep experimenting and practicing our art, you know, and sharing it with the world, you know. And that's my dream, to be able to play my music, the music of innovative jazz, the way I'm playing it, and further for the rest of my life, at least 350 days a year, if not 360, you know?
I hear you. Yeah. Hey,
yeah.
And look, from my perspective, I totally understand that. And the way it's going to be happening is, you know, some of these terrestrial radio stations. I love that I can do this show. I love that there are other internet scenarios where they're playing jazz and satellite radio stations. But honestly, we need something back that becomes a clone on terrestrial radio so that people can access jazz all the time. When that
right.
happens, the clubs will flourish again.
Right. That's what we need. That's
yep.
exactly what we need. Because jazz is a performance art. It's a performing art. It's
yeah.
a living performing art. And we need to be playing. And, you know, and we need groups. You know, we don't need to be just, I want to be like the Miles Davis Quintet or John Coltrane Quartet, or Ornette Coleman Quartet or Charlie Parker Quintet, you know, we or Mingus's Workshop. We need these things, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree. And you know how fickle we are in the States, Wallace. A lot of times it's out of sight, out of mind. So if people don't have the wherewithal to get up in the morning, they're in their bedroom, they're hearing it, they turn on their radio, you know, they're going to sleep or making love or whatever, or out in the kitchen at 3 o'clock in the morning, they need a places to go to where jazz is accessible. So it becomes a love affair again, and not these stations that only play it part-time. We got to have full-time jazz commercial stations to make it a moneymaker, because that's what people understand is money, unfortunately.
Right. And it's funny because we need money to subsidize our art, but jazz musicians don't think about, after that, when we play, we don't think about that. We just, jazz musicians are pretty pure as far as the art goes, you know. I understand what you're saying, you know.
Oh, these folks around here, because, you know, Baltimore, D.C. is full of, and Philly down the road, full of unbelievable jazz musicianship, and what they get paid or not paid in a given night is a crime.
Right.
You know how that goes.
Yes, you know, I know, yes.
I know, you know. Well, God bless you. I'm so glad that you spent all this time. Say hello to Chick for me, and have a wonderful time. And any time that you're in the area, I'm going to find out, and I'll come see you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You are a treasure. I'm so glad. Even though we were supposed to do this before, it was supposed to be today. That's all there is to it.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're great. I think that you apart from the fact that Miles thought the world of you, there are legions of fans who know you for the work that's inside your soul, as well as what you were able to do with Miles's music. So I consider you one of the great ones.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome, Wallace. Have a blast tonight.
Okay, thanks.
And have a happy Thanksgiving, and give Dawn a big hug and kiss for me.
I sure will. She's going to love it. I will.
Well, and I told her about the archives, and after this live situation is over, by tonight the archive will be available, so I'll make sure that somehow, some way she gets it, and you too.
Okay, great. That would be great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wallace. God bless, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Trish. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah. Everybody, this is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy, and just amazing. We were in a situation a couple of months ago where Wallace was supposed to be here, and there's a scheduling conflict. No doubt in my mind that he was supposed to be with us today. I'm really moved by what he had to say. So thrilled that he was able to share the stories that he shared, because some of that stuff is personal, you know? And it's just mind-boggling that there is this kind of musicianship in the world to have these kinds of stories. We need to nourish these stories. We need to make sure that music lives on, and go support the artists when they are playing. And along those lines, at the Blue Note tonight, there are the shows involved with Chick Corea, etc. So if you're in the New York area, please support Wallace and Chick, and make sure that you express to them how much you appreciated Wallace sharing so much with us today. Let's play another song for If Only for One Night, shall we? I think that we should do the title track, If Only for One Night, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Yeah, enjoy. Thank you. I'm really reeling, okay? That was just such a stunning time with Wallace Roney. That was recorded at the Iridium in New York a couple of years ago, if only for one night, title track from the CD. Wish Wallace all the best tonight with Chick and Company at the Blue Note, and I know we'll be talking to him again down the road. It's going to be great in the next several days. Now, we're going to be talking to Stanley Cooper this coming Tuesday, an amazing guitarist who has been with not only local and regional folks, but international folks as well. He's in demand, and you're going to be hearing why. We also, in the next many days, are going to have Chris McNulty, a wonderful jazz singer whose name you may know, and you may know about her extraordinary son, Sam, who passed away in July of this year. Chris is not only going to be talking about her career, but Sam's amazing career as well. Just really extraordinary to hear this story. We're also going to have in the next many days Luis Munoz and Hakan Graf talking about his band Graffiti with Dennis Chambers. And it's just going to be a real nice heading into the Christmas season kind of venture here on Hyper Jazz from Trish Hennessy. God bless all of you for your support, and we'll see you on Tuesday with Stanley. Have a great weekend. Be safe. And remember to support live jazz.